In the 15 or so years since social networks like Twitter and Facebook were founded, they have swiftly revolutionized the political process and how Americans engage with it. They've changed how people follow politics. Almost 70% of Americans say they get news from social media. They've changed how candidates run for office. For the first time, political campaigns and organizations are expected to spend more than $1 billion in digital ads this election cycle. And they've changed how politicians communicate with their constituents, from Donald Trump's tweets to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Instagram Lives. But despite their growing impact on politics, social media platforms remain a largely unregulated space, a free-for-all of news, opinions, and advertisements available to consumers whenever they open their laptops or smartphones. Now, after seeing the repercussions that had as fake news rapidly spread online in the 2016 election, some politicians are seeking to toughen the legal regulations that govern social media companies. And the companies themselves are taking a heavier hand in cracking down on misinformation and abuse on their platforms, including from some of those very same politicians. On this episode of Wake Up to Politics, I talk to Issy Lepowski, a reporter who covers the intersection of tech and politics for the new site Protocol, about the efforts by President Trump and others to rein in social media companies, mainly by reforming a key provision, Section 230, which offers the companies protections that Trump sought to limit in a recent executive order.
You know, the companies that you interact with every day would look very different, and your ability to speak your mind and share with friends and whatnot would be really limited without Section 230.
The results of the fight over Section 230 could have an expansive impact on American life and could be the next major battleground in our nation's long-running debate over the freedom of speech and what it means. Later in the episode, you'll also hear from veteran journalist Sanford Unger, now the head of the Georgetown Free Speech Project, to hear some perspective on the First Amendment implications of the debate over regulating social media.
What we have always claimed makes this country different from almost all others is that people can speak up without worry about being arrested, without worry about being persecuted or prosecuted. Yet today, some of those rights seem particularly under challenge, and especially online.
I'm Gabe Fleischer, and from St. Louis Public Radio and me, this is Wake Up to Politics. Although Section 230 now plays a crucial role in how social media companies operate, it actually predates most of them entirely. The provision comes from the Communications Decency Act of 1996. When people refer to Section 230, they are mostly referring to this paragraph, which has often been called the 26 words that created the internet. Here they are. No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. In essence, those 26 words established that internet companies wouldn't be treated as the publishers of the posts on their sites, but merely the platforms for them. In other words, they're the newsstand, not the newspaper. Most critically, the provision protected these companies from being sued for whatever is written in these posts. Issy Lepowski, who reports on tech and politics for Protocol, explains what that means in practice.
Without Section 230, you would have companies really opening themselves up to so much liability. And so it would really prevent a lot of innovative startups from coming online because they just wouldn't have the money to withstand all those legal threats.
Section 230 is what allowed the tech platforms we all know and use every day to crop up in the United States and foster innovation and communication, all without fear of legal threats.
It has enabled the United States to become sort of the center of the internet economy.
But as we all know, there's a dark side to social media as well. And critics say Section 230 enables dangerous content like misinformation and harassment to flourish on social media platforms unchecked.
So the big argument against social media companies having that kind of immunity is it means that a lot of bad stuff takes place on their platforms, and victims of that bad stuff, say that's, you know, parents whose children have appeared in child sexual abuse material, or the victims of online stalking or harassment, other, you know, terrible things that take place on these platforms, they really have very little recourse. There are certainly federal laws that can punish the person who posted the content in a lot of cases, but a lot of victims want these companies to be held accountable, and understandably so. I mean, they, you know, they're taking, they're essentially profiting off a lot of this stuff because they're selling ads against the engagement that they're getting from often illegal, illicit, or at the very least objectionable materials. So there are two really compelling sides of the argument. One is that these companies are going to, you know, be faced with just a barrage of lawsuits. And the other side of it is that, well, on the other end of those lawsuits are people who potentially have been really hurt.
These concerns led a bipartisan group of lawmakers to introduce legislation to reform Section 230 earlier this year.
There was a bill introduced called the Earn It Act, and this was introduced by Senator Lindsey Graham and I believe Senator Richard Blumenthal. And they were proposing that companies would essentially have to adhere to a list of best practices that would be developed by a working group inside the DOJ, and that working group would include the Attorney General. And that working group would come up with a list of best practices that companies had to adhere to in order to earn their Section 230 protections.
Proposals like that one have generally focused on amending Section 230 to correct for the dark parts of social media that critics say the provision has allowed, like human trafficking and child sexual exploitation. But the question of whether social media companies should be held liable for posts on their sites was thrust back into the news last month due to another issue entirely. A dispute between Twitter and President Donald Trump himself. After years of facing pressure for their response to the president's often controversial tweets, the company took action against one of Trump's tweets for the first time in late May. At issue was an assertion from the president about mail-in voting, which Twitter left up, but marked as potentially misleading. 2 days later, the president signed an executive order to limit the protections offered to companies like Twitter by Section 230.
What I was told by a source at the White House was that this was totally something that popped up right after Twitter made its decision. The president, you know, turned to his staff and said, do something about this. And they quickly, within a matter of days, rushed this executive order through.
The executive order was part of a broader critique President Trump has made that social media companies are biased against conservatives. I asked Issy if that accusation was a fair one.
I would argue there isn't a lot of evidence, and I would say, if anything, there's evidence to the contrary. You have, you know, on Facebook, conservative content is hugely popular, and on any given day, often more popular than content that you might categorize as liberal. Obviously, President Trump has built a gigantic following on Twitter, is arguably their, you know, their biggest account on Twitter. So it's hard to argue that he's being silenced. And what we know from some reporting, particularly reporting that came out in the Wall Street Journal recently, is that, you know, Facebook has been very careful not to silence conservative voices, even if they believe that doing so would enable them to crack down on some of the more extremist content. So in this Wall Street Journal article, Facebook found that a lot of people who are joining extremist groups are joining them based on Facebook's recommendations. But they found that that changing those recommendations or altering the content that they suggest to people might end up having a disproportionate effect on conservatives, and for that reason decided not to take those actions. And so I think what you're finding is, in fact, the opposite. Facebook in particular being quite conscious of the impact that they're having on conservatives and being quite conscious of not trying to have any bias.
The strain of criticism that conservatives are more likely to be censored by social media networks also comes back to Section 230. But to another lesser-known provision that comes right after the 26 words that created the internet. It's called the Good Samaritan provision.
And it basically says that not only will platforms not be held liable for the things that are put on their platforms, but also that if they, in good faith, attempt to moderate what's on their platforms, they cannot be held liable for the decisions that they make, if they get it right or if they get it wrong. So in other words, if they fail to catch something that should have been taken down, or if they take something down that people feel was taken down in error, they can't be held liable for those decisions as well.
Essentially, the president's point, even though Issy says there isn't much evidence to back it up, is that social media companies aren't acting in good faith like the provision requires. Instead, they're acting out of bias against conservatives. Here's what he said in the executive order.
The argument that the president made is, in part, that tech companies have amassed this incredible power, and they are the place that people are going to get their news. They are the place that people are going to express their viewpoints, and nobody ever could have anticipated that at sort of the dawn of the creation of these companies. And all of that is a fair point. But the remedy that he's seeking is to change Section 230, and he proposes to do that in two ways. He essentially orders the Commerce Department to petition the FCC and the FTC to undertake reviews of these social media platforms and of Section 230. With regard to the FCC, the president wants the FCC to reassess Section 230 and to come up with some regulations that would determine when a company is actually shielded from liability. What are the circumstances under which they are considered to be acting in good faith? And are there any circumstances in which their moderation policies are actually deceptive? And I know a lot of legal scholars, I am not one, but a lot of legal scholars have said that, you know, this is really sort of crazy because the FCC doesn't really have the power to make policy with regard to Section 230. He's also calling on the FTC to look at whether any of the accusations of conservative bias constitute deceptive practices by these tech companies. And a third proposal that it makes is to have the government agencies reassess their spending on these social media platforms, and then to have the DOJ determine, you know, whether they're spending money on platforms that are, practicing some kind of bias. So it's really trying to go after the conservative bias issues with regard to Section 230, and not any of the sort of broader issues, the issues around, you know, the proliferation of child sexual abuse material or terrorist content or illicit opioid sales or any of the other issues that, you know, a lot of the would-be reformers of Section 230 have brought to attention.
So, as Issy said, it's dubious whether the order will actually lead to an immediate change in the enforcement of Section 230. But it did lead to the spilling out of tensions that have been bubbling up for years between Trump and the networks that contributed to his political rise. On the same day that he signed his executive order, President Trump sent a tweet threatening to shoot individuals looting businesses amid the riots after George Floyd's killing in Minneapolis. And for the first time, Twitter hid the tweet with the message that it was glorifying violence. The next day, Trump called for Section 230 to be repealed entirely by Congress. As he did so, the president placed the First Amendment at the center of his argument, arguing that Twitter was stifling his freedom of speech by hiding his tweet. But at the same time, lawsuits have been filed against his executive order on social media, arguing that it is the president who is targeting free speech. Up next, First Amendment expert Sanford Unger will help us sort through these conflicting claims. Earlier in the episode, I said that social media regulation is still a fairly new area of law. But Sanford Unger, the director of the Georgetown Free Speech Project, surprised me when he told me that even though the First Amendment is more than two centuries old, all case law surrounding freedom of speech is actually newer than you might think.
The First Amendment sort of sat there for its first, 150 years. It's really only about 100 years ago now that the Supreme Court began to look at a lot of First Amendment cases, free speech cases, other First Amendment issues. And so it's, relatively speaking, it's century-old jurisprudence. And it's intriguing to think that, you know, the first important free speech cases really from the Supreme Court about 100 years ago had to do with pamphlets, leaflets that protesters against the draft were printing, the famous Schenck v. U.S. case, dropping leaflets from the top of the Empire State Building in another case. And so in the space of 100 years, we've gone from leaflets to the internet with a lot of stops in between.
As Professor Unger says, the laws that were first tested because of pamphlets at the height of World War I would then be tested again and again as new technologies cropped up, and Americans debated what could be said on radio, and then what could be said on television, and so forth. The internet poses an entirely new challenge for the fight over free speech, as the traditional media gatekeepers that held power in the age of radio and television have given way to the more democratized forum of social media. Suddenly, many more people have the ability to reach larger audiences through their social media platforms. And for the most part, they can say anything, sometimes even broadcasting messages that are dangerous or untrue.
Social media now are very much in the on the firing line, because things that appear on the internet obviously move so fast, and there is no proof that anybody has carefully researched or thought about some of the things that are said on the internet. In fact, on the contrary, the internet is very vulnerable to conspiracy theories and accusations that have no real basis in fact. So there is a drama going on, and it will continue to go on, about whether there is some reasonable kind of regulation that can take place, which is not subject to political manipulation about free speech, about truth and falsehood.
In some ways, these new pathways for communication created by social media are the fulfillment of both the First Amendment and Section 230, which were attempts to protect open forums in their own times. Now we are wrestling with the backlash, wondering whether the forum has become too open.
Well, that's what people were hoping for when Section 230 was written, that it would be a place for innovation, a place that would protect speech, encourage new social media to come forward. I think the problem is that it's obviously been abused, as many freedoms are, and we have to hope for wise leadership and civil discussion to try to figure out what are reasonable rules, what are reasonable ground rules for the use of the internet.
But the next question is who should step in and do the policing. With his executive order, President Trump is following the lead of some in Congress who believe the federal government should play a larger role in regulating social media. But that creates a tricky line for regulators, who can't go too far in tamping down speech online for fear of violating the First Amendment, which protects American citizens from having their speech suppressed by the U.S. government.
The executive order says that, would say that government bureaucracies can step in and say what speech is acceptable on the internet and what speech is not. And of course, the obvious risk is that this regulation and these rules would be content-based. And that's totally taboo under the First Amendment, to regulate speech on the basis of content. Free speech is not absolute. We all know it. That, for example, it can be regulated if it looks as if it's going to lead to violence, then speech can be prevented. There are Supreme Court precedents that govern that. But this would be a regulation that would basically say, well, the current president's nominees to the Federal Communications Commission don't like what's on Facebook or what's on Twitter, and so they can take action against them.
Professor Unger says that although there are obvious risks to the explosion of free speech that comes along with social media, it also means that there has been no time when the First Amendment could be more essential.
You could almost say it was written for today. Now is when we really need it. Now is when we need something to guarantee the right to free expression, to free speech, to free press. And that doesn't mean it's easy to interpret it. It doesn't mean it's easy to apply or figure out. And yet today, some of those rights seem particularly under challenge, and especially online in some cases.
Of course, the president has also cited the First Amendment as part of his campaign against social media companies, claiming that he is being censored by Twitter and losing his right to free expression. But, Professor Unger notes, a plain text reading of the First Amendment only addresses suppression of speech on the part of the government. The actions of private companies aren't mentioned.
Restaurant, for example, can't be accused of violating free speech, of censoring people, because it is a business. It can set its own rules for itself. You can challenge those rules sometimes in court, and you can try to challenge them in federal court and say this is a violation of the Constitution. You would have trouble winning, but you might be able to prevail. But generally speaking, it is very difficult to claim violations of the First Amendment.
But even though the First Amendment doesn't explicitly forbid social media companies from taking posts down, since the dawn of the internet, bolstered by Section 230, these companies have mostly let free speech reign on their platforms, for better or for worse. However, as the companies find themselves unable to completely stamp out harassment and misinformation on their platforms, the tide seems to be finally turning towards more regulation.
This is all very much on the frontier right now, and if these were calmer times, I think we would have an easier time that would give us more confidence that these things are going to be worked out in a fair and judicious manner. I think right now, with the country as polarized as it is, and social media at times appearing to aggravate that polarization, I think it's worrisome about whether it will be worked out or not. I think most observers of social media believe that regulation of some sort is inevitable, but they also believe the government will mess it up, at least at the start.
My guests today were Issy Lepowski and Sanford Unger. You can find Issy's reporting on Section 230 and other issues at protocol.com. You can find out more about Professor Unger's work tracking threats to free speech, online and off, at freespeechproject.georgetown.edu. The Wake Up to Politics podcast is produced by me, Gabe Fleischer, and Tim Lloyd, the senior producer of on-demand and content partnerships at St. Louis Public Radio. To get the latest political news in your inbox every weekday morning, you can sign up for my newsletter at wakeuptopolitics.com.